The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
I'm Wesley Morris.
I'm Jenna Wortham, and this is Still Processing. All right, so what are we processing this week?
Well, you had a really good conversation with the Women of Girls.
I did. I mean, thank you.
And I figure since the show's about to start this weekend,
yes,
it's a good time to think about what the show means.
Yes.
And
we're this is the last season of Girls after 6 or 7 years.
We have overthought it, ignored it, been dismissive of it, been in love with it. And now it's leaving, and it's been really interesting to think about. You and I were both a part of something that the New York Times did, assessing the show's place in various pantheons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really heartening to read these people, including us, try to figure out what this show means. So we're going to talk about that for a minute. And then listen to your conversation that you had with Lena Dunham and Allison Williams and
Jemima Kirk
and Zasha Mamet. Yeah. And then we got to have a technology politics boycott situation.
Convo. So much is happening.
So the weekend of the executive order craziness, one of the things.
That's what we're officially calling it, executive order craziness. I mean,
is there a better.
Number one, the first executive order craziness. No, that's why I'm laughing. It's perfect.
There's still fallout. They're still fighting in court about whether the order can pass or not, or whether the order should stand or not. And one of the things that happened that weekend was Uber and people deleting their Uber accounts because, well, you tell me why. Why did that happen?
People were deleting Uber from their phones for a couple reasons. One, because Travis Kalanick, one of the CEOs, I mean, he's the CEO and one of the founders, I should say. He's on Trump's advisory board to do IDK, no one knows what, but he's been photographed in the White House. He's been on it from the very beginning, ostensibly to have the president's ear as though we're in medieval times. Like, who has the king's ear this week? It's, like, so bonkers to me that that's a thing we say. But also because when the New York City taxi company or commissioner, however it works, decided to enact a very symbolic protest and by striking for an hour and picking people up and dropping them off from John F. Kennedy Airport in support of protest against the immigration ban that was signed into order, Uber was still running. People read it as a sign that they were scabs. They were not supporting this larger symbolic moment in New York City. People were pissed. The CEO took to Twitter to talk about it. He said, oh, we're going to release funds to make sure that our drivers aren't, you know, that they have financial support during this period of time, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we care a lot about immigrants. Like, without immigrants, you wouldn't have Uber, et cetera, et cetera. Wasn't enough to appease people. And according to our own reporter, Mike Isaac and Recode and a lot of other places, about 200,000 people deleted their apps in the United States alone.
So while people were deleting their Uber apps, Lyft announced that it was munificently donating $1 million to the ACLU.
$1 million out of how many millions of dollars it makes every year? I don't know. I am very cynical about all of this. I mean, on one hand, there is a very high-level way to look at this, which is that I think it's incredibly important for people, in particular Americans right now, to feel that they have, who don't agree with the administration and its policies, to feel they have recourse, to feel like they have, that their voices can be heard.
Yes.
We saw that happen over the weekend when Cuomo stepped in and said, we're not going to enforce this ban, we're going to let people land and we're going to, you know, whatever. Like, we see that protest and demonstration is working.
Yes.
But what it means for the CEO of a company like Uber that's valued in the multi-billions, that is installed all over the entire world,
yeah.
I just have a really hard time believing that that actually matters in terms of what Trump's going to do and what his policies are.
Yes. Okay. So we are having this conversation not too far away from the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
during which I saw an Airbnb ad.
This is what I wanted to say before. So when people were saying, we're not going to use Uber anymore, people were saying, I'm going to use Lyft instead. Lyft is not any better. Lyft is also funded by Peter Thiel. The point that I'm trying to make is that Silicon Valley right now is so embedded with the U.S. government in ways that are beyond our comprehension, that are not visible to any of us. So thinking that banning one of these apps, if you're going to ban Uber, if you're going to boycott Uber, throw your iPhone in the trash, delete your Facebook account, stop using Twitter. Like Twitter, I mean, all of these companies are in some way supporting this administration.
It's a moral protest whack-a-mole. You hit Lyft, but up comes Uber.
And Airbnb,
you hit Airbnb,
is like,
up comes something else. And the thing you're hitting it with is also a problem.
These are all gestures, and how full or empty they are is something I'm just not clear on. Like Airbnb said, they aired this beautiful commercial during the Super Bowl.
It was a beautiful commercial.
Which you saw live. How did you feel when you saw that commercial?
Kind of nauseated because it was so good.
It was so emotional and so beautiful. Reminded me of like early Apple ads where you just like, or those Google search ads where you just like couldn't help but cry, and I'm angry at myself for crying. That was essentially like, we're all one, and like, we're all human, and like, humanism is the way, and like, we're da-da-da. And then Brian Chesky, who's the CEO of Airbnb, who's very diesel and very swole, which every time I say his name, I just think about like shirtless photos I've seen of him, like in GQ. It's very weird. Anyway,
why are you doing this to me?
Because it's like interesting. It just adds to the confusion
of
the company.
I'm trying to stay mad, Jenna.
Well, you'd be mad if you saw these photos. It would just increase your anger, actually.
Okay.
But they sent out this email that's like, we're going to pledge short-term housing to 100,000 people over the next 5 years. It's like when McDonald's sells salads. It's still fast food. You know what I mean? A McDonald's salad is still from McDonald's.
I can't trust a McDonald's salad just because it's salad at McDonald's. You know what I mean? Like, just because it's not a Big Mac. Okay, you got me. You got me. This lettuce is probably fine.
There is this bigger discussion that we have to be having, which is that all these companies at the end of the day are looking out for their bottom line. They're looking at increasing value for their shareholders. None of them are doing good, even though they're making these gestures to, like, appease their followers. How dumb do they think we are?
I feel like one of the things that you and I have been talking about when we have these conversations about, like, technology creep, I don't know how we disentangle ourselves from.
Right.
I mean,
right.
This is almost, in some ways, to me, not terribly different from name your oil company.
That's right.
Name your natural resource company. These things wind up entangling. They become necessary parts of your life.
Right.
And then the question is, like, what do you do to disentangle yourself short of, like, walking everywhere and wearing no clothes?
The upside to me is that turning a very critical eye on these companies we've become overly dependent on and asking ourselves, what are they doing for me? How are they exacerbating the wealth and inequality disparities that already exist in our country and around the world? These are very important conversations to have.
Yes.
I think it was just frustrating for me to watch over the weekend declarations of banning Uber on Twitter and on Facebook from people who are also donating money to the ACLU, but then not talking about how the ACLU is now partnering with a startup incubator called Y Combinator that's run in part by Peter Thiel.
Where's the window? Can I jump out? Can I jump out now?
I tweeted this last week and I stand by it. We need a schoolhouse rock for the Trump administration. We need people. We need explainers. We need, because all of this stuff is connected.
Think about what your relationship is to your stuff if you're not already doing it. And think about what it actually does mean to get rid of your Uber app. And like, in getting rid of it and going to Lyft, what have you really done? You know, I mean, it is like, there is a kind of whack-a-mole here. You can delete one of these companies, but another one's just going to pop up in its place that you're going to need.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you may not like Spotify, but you might be using Tidal.
We love Tidal. It all comes back. Wait, this entire segment was a plug for Tidal, Wesley Morris. I can't believe you. I'm so proud of you.
I try. I really do.
You know who's got to make some money, though?
Oh, boy.
Mama and the Papa, so.
We'll be right back.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
A couple days ago, I had the pleasure of watching you walk onto stage with Lena Dunham and Allison Williams and Jemima Kirk and Zasha Mamet. And you talked about girls and the energy was really crazy. There were all these people in the room, mm-hmm. in the enormous room. Desperate to hear you guys talk. We're going to play a little bit of that in a second. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful, by the way. It was a pleasure to sit there and like, it was very funny.
Yeah, shout out the Times Talk for asking me to do it.
You were great. They were great. Oh. I had a very good time. But the show is ending. It's been on TV for 6 seasons of television.
Yeah.
And it's coming to a close.
Yep.
I'm going to miss it.
I'm coming around to the idea of missing it. But what I'm interested in from your perspective, because you watch TV a lot more objectively than I do. So when Girls first aired in 2012, it was very hard for me to watch it, to take it for what it was, which was just a piece of writing by a woman about this world that she wanted to create and comment on. I had a really strong reaction to it. And now in hindsight, I'm like, there's enough cultural context for me to be able to watch it a mm-hmm. little more even-handedly now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to put it into context even now. Was it important? Is the last season going to matter? Are people going to watch it?
I think it's definitely an important show.
Okay.
I think, you know,
why?
I've got a crazy thing to tell you.
Okay.
When Mary Tyler Moore died,
okay,
I tweeted out a list of the 5 most important women in the history of television.
Okay.
My list was Lucille Ball's number 1, yes. Mary Tyler Moore and Oprah. I tied at number 2.
Okay.
Number 3 was Barbara Walters. Number 4 with the tie was Carol Burnett. And I was like, people were tweeting back at me like, well, what about all these other people who would be 6 through 10? Lena Dunham is probably 7.
Okay.
I would say in the history, it's a crazy thing to say because it hasn't been that many years, but Lena Dunham is probably number 7.
Interesting.
Or number 8. There's been nobody as interested in television comedy satire that also goes out as far and as wide as her show does,
uh-huh.
as Lena Dunham is interested in making it.
Yeah.
But I really love this show because I understand what it's going for. That's not why I love it, but it wants to get at something and it gets at it pretty much every single episode. And I love the worlds that already exist that it inserts itself into,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
finds a way to make fun of them, and also not back down from how obnoxious its characters are.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of unlikable people. I think Marnie is one of the like most obnoxious creations in the history of television.
Although let me just interrupt you for a second,
yes.
though. There is an argument to be made that is not about obnoxious people. I mean, I think it's just, if you are a woman of color, if you're a black woman like I am, you deal with these women from the moment you wake up.
Oh, they're real.
To the moment you go to bed. And spending my leisure time with these women was not something that I wanted to do in 2013
Listen,
or 2014. Now, true. I will say now, because I do have all these other shows where I can watch and I can relate. I understand the jokes. I understand the references. You know, Insecure being one of them, Atlanta being another. Even shows like Broad City, Fleabag. Like, it's easier for me to watch Girls because it is not the only
There's
thing
a
I
landscape
watch
that exists
where women
now.
My age are on television.
Right.
So it's easier to watch it now. But I think as someone who watches TV for escapism, for humor, for commentary, that show was a very difficult pill to swallow for a lot of people, including mm-hmm. myself. So right. I think you have a very interesting critic's perspective, but I do think the reason that show rubs people the wrong way is because, you know, those women are the women who flick their wet hair on me on the subway every day when I'm just trying to get to my job. And I don't want to feel someone stringing wet hair on my cheek. And yet it happens once every other week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So yeah. It's like, I don't want to sit down with them also in the evening. All that said, though, I think now I do understand that the show, the writing is brilliant. The humor is unparalleled. I mean, it's, and look, I mean, all of my personal feelings aside, when the credits run and it says written, directed, starring, et cetera, and it's all of a woman in her 20s, like, I applaud that. Like, there's no part of me that is not, my cold heart beams with pride at that because I recognize how outstanding of a feat that is.
I just want to say one specific thing that's an achievement about this show that maybe we can talk about later when it ends, but I think Zasha Mamet gave one of the great TV performances.
Phenomenal.
I think she is the person who had the least on paper to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And through sheer vision and talent, found a character who might have real world corollaries. I know that Shoshanas do exist, but she seemed to get a joke that was bigger than the character, but also was determined to play this character as a person.
And what I love about her as and her character is that it is impossible, because she sounds just like Shoshana or Joshadez, it is impossible to separate the two of them when you're looking at them, I think. But from what I know about her life, judging from the various yoga classes I've seen her in, her Instagram, she is a very engaged person in the world. Like, she is always raising money for a cause. She's always out here living her best holistic life. She's extremely low-key. And so it's very funny to realize that she will probably be forever linked as the character she played, but she could not be farther from the
character
that
she played. Well, what's interesting, though, is they caught Shoshana up with, I mean, that's the person Shoshana wound up becoming.
It's so
right?
true. That's
this
a good point.
This woman on a journey. More than any of those other characters,
I've
found where Shoshana begins and where she winds up to be the most compelling. Like that last episode of the last season of season 5 with her figuring out how to make Ray's business a business.
Yeah.
It was, first of all, that's the best satire on the show. I think the Iowa Writers Workshop was second best.
Yeah.
But all of the stuff around reawakening Ray's Cafe was just some of the best social satire I've not ever seen on TV, but it's really, really good. Mm-hmm. It's like top 10 of all time good.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that show. I think I'm going to miss it when it's gone. We're not going to mourn it because we'll do that when it ends. But let's just play play part of your conversation with them.
Welcome.
Now we all open our waters.
Yes.
We do.
Everyone's got water. Oh my God, everyone looks amazing.
And I know she should be allowed to start, but I just want to say, because it's a compliment to her, I'm not like Kanye.
I'm a lesbian.
No, Kanye me.
Which is that you've played such an important role in the life of this show because you wrote one of the most thoughtful and important pieces about the diversity issue the first season that really forced us and me to grow and stretch as writers. So I've always really thought about you as one of the girls, Jenna.
Oh, no.
Yeah?
No.
But anyway, it's a real honor for us to be here with you.
Well, you responded so kindly to that. We'll get to that in a moment in the questions, but I felt there was a real testament to what you all were trying to do with the show and what you were trying to do with the show that you wrote back. You wrote me a really nice email and you were just like, thank you.
Well, that thank you.
Yeah. And thank you all for coming. There was a line outside. It was very exciting. So.
Aww, wow.
I want to take a look back at the earliest days of the show so we can see how far you guys have come.
Whoa. Wow.
Hi.
Oh, hey, what the heck are you doing here?
I thought you didn't want to see us anymore.
I couldn't bear the idea of not seeing you before you left town. But more importantly, here, you can sit down. It's late, I'm sorry. Is that I brought you my book. I need you to read it. Jesus, it's hot.
Great. That's fun.
Yeah.
Are you boiling?
Great, we'll read it on the plane.
No, now. I need you to read it now because I don't want to freak you out, but I think that I may be the voice of my generation. Or at least a voice of a generation.
On a totally superficial level, I remember thinking, because we were shooting the pilot and I'd never had like you know, I'd made movies before, but I'd never had, like, hair and makeup people on set. And I would look in the mirror every day and be like, I could not be more beautiful. Like, I thought my hair looked amazing. Like, that was the moment where it was really cool. People were starting to kind of, like, do that casual dry bar, like, barrel roll with a curling iron. And I was like, I look spectacular. And now I look at that, I'm like, what a scrubkin. But, you know what's so interesting about that scene is, like, that line will probably, like, end up on my gravestone or in my obituary in some way. And I'm not blaming anyone but myself, although Jenny Connor did write it. But the thing that's interesting about looking at that scene is how much that line has become this subject of debate and at times derision relating to the show. And the thing I always have to remind people is, like, you know, my character said it when she was on drugs and it was a joke. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't me being like, I'm here, I'm queer, get used to it. It was a real, you know,
it happens with a lot of lines that you say, though. And that, I think, was the one that started it, was everyone goes, she thinks she's a voice for a generation? Like, they forgot they were watching a TV show?
Yeah, so I looked,
or like a story.
When I was still looking at Twitter, I'd get all these things that are like, you're not the voice of my generation. I'd be like, I didn't say I was.
But if I may, I think you are. I think you are, and I'm very comfortable with that. You, as my voice, are much funnier and more interesting. So I will happily let you be my voice, and I am terrified for the time when you are no longer writing the words that I say.
Thank you, Al. That means a lot. That means a lot. But some people in our generation voted for Trump, so who even knows?
Hashtag facts. What was it like being that young and being in that thrust in that spotlight and feeling scrutiny that isn't applied to a show like, I don't know, any other show with all men, you know?
Silicon Valley's not getting it from behind the way, but at the same time, I mean, I love Silicon Valley, but it's funny. It's like, it is interesting that you can have a kind of similar format, which is, you know, four men representative of a generation, and there's a sense that
they're actors.
They're actors, and we're just ladies.
Yeah, but like, somehow our characters and the writing and who we are gets enmeshed with us as real people. You know, the writing becomes what our beliefs, you know, rather than a story that's being told.
Or characters that are saying lines.
Well, yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. Allison said this thing the other day, which really hit me hard, and then she said it again in this oral history did for The Hollywood Reporter, where she was like, guy does a sex scene and it's brave and it's bold and it's whatever it is, and then she did the sex scene that she did at the beginning of season 4.
And that was amazing.
Which was like a big, beautiful, I mean, you...
It was the one with me bent over a counter.
Yeah, she was bent over a counter and something was happening to a part of her body. And literally every headline was like, Allison Williams gets her ass eaten.
Yeah,
But Allison Williams gets her ass eaten,
not Marnie.
This is what happened in the story.
But that's clickbait, like, I get it, but also, I don't know, I'm not convinced that anyone would have written the article that was like, Bryan Cranston makes meth. Right?
I agree. And it was crazy. I mean, I think we were always working is the thing. So it's like, we shot the first season. By the time all of the reaction to the first season came out, we were already shooting our second season. By the time we had gotten awards, we were deep into our third season. We always had the work to return to. Mm-hmm. And the four of us, plus Jenny and Judd, we were always very blessedly on the same page about it and believed in what we were doing and became this, like, huddle. And we became this team that was really committed to continuing, but there were definitely, you know, you can't help it. Even if you're a thoughtful, engaged person who appreciates constructive criticism, you can't help sometimes just be like, why?
I know. Okay, I want to talk about the particular type of humor in the show. And we have another clip. Clip number 2, please.
Principal Toby, I think I've told you that my father's gay, yes?
Oh, yeah.
So he just called me from a Midtown hotel room sobbing, and that leads me to believe that something pretty invasive has happened to his body. So I feel like I've got to get there kind of on the quick.
Yeah, okay. I like you. I really like you. And I think you...
I like you too. You're one of the smartest people I've ever met, and so gentle and so kind, and I feel like we work really well together. So just, you know, have Shayna check in on my class, and I'll be back ASAP.
What I love about that clip is when I rewatched, I was like kind of picking and choosing and skipping back around. There's this thing that you're making fun of, but also not, and there's this way that you're looking at this sort of treacherous march towards adulthood and how as the show progresses, we all know you get to adulthood and the book is still not written, like you still don't have the answers, you don't know how to be, and
there's a very delicate act that you're doing and using the characters to make fun of their self-involvement, but also help them grow through it. And I'm just curious to hear you all talk about that brand of humor, which I think, it's not that people missed it, but it definitely belongs in the same category as a show like Veep or a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I don't think people really, well, I didn't get the first one. I won't speak for the world, but.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the point that was being made earlier, which is like a lot of it didn't get attributed or the credit wasn't given to the writers. A lot of people thought we were genuinely that like privileged seeming and unself-aware and didn't understand that there is a line between the words we say on the show and the people we're pretending to be and the people we are in real life. And had there been more appreciation for that, which there might have been if we were male actors, then I think the jokes would have gotten more credit because people would have been able to say, oh, these self-aware people are making jokes pretending to be unself-aware people. Mm-hmm. And since so much of the humor reflects the very navel-gazy culture that this show is coming out of, I think that was a crucial thing for people to latch onto, and only a select few people who could really see through the performance of it started to realize that when someone says, I may be the voice of a generation, that she's not, Lena wasn't proclaiming that. That was Hannah Horvath high in her parents' hotel room, shoving a tiny book, I guess, in their hands and declaring that about herself.
What I remember before the show came out, Judd was saying, like, this is a real commentary on, like, millennial privilege and, like, middle-class white female privilege, which is, like, something that we should sure as fuck know we need to examine now that 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. Like, that's a conversation that needs to be had. And so it's like we were never, ever really given the benefit of the doubt besides from a select few people that we knew what we were doing and that our show was a commentary. People were just like, thought we were like fun, like wild white girls run.
It was a tragic documentary reality series about
it was people basically talked about it like it was The Hills. And we were like, we have like a staff of like extremely experienced writers here like telling you stories and crafting them every week. And if I had, someone asked me earlier, like, do you have any regrets? And I was like, sometimes I feel like the artistry of these amazing people I worked with, whether it was cinematographers or actors or writers, was lost in the noise, the think piecey noise around the show.
I think it got lost as a piece of artwork for everyone involved.
I think a lot of it got lost as well, though, because it was so subtle. Like, we were making a commentary, but we weren't pulling any punches. And it is a comedy, but it's also incredibly dark because it's so honest. And it's incredibly dark because it's so honest and it's speaking to a generation who's experiencing the things that we're shining a really harsh light upon.
But people don't like the word honest when we use it because they think we're meaning honest about everybody.
Yeah, no,
which
we're
is
just
not
right.
True.
We're talking
it's
about
honest from this perspective. It's
exactly.
Honest from this is what I want to say and I'm gonna try and say it.
I want to hear from you guys if you have like your most memorable moments on set or scenes or even your least favorite, like what
ever.
Or just whatever comes into your mind.
I'm sorry, I should not have started with the one. I'm gonna take
you
that.
You dove right
back.
In.
No, can you please stop me? Stop
okay.
me.
Okay, stop her before she kills again.
One of my most favorite and also kind of least favorite was the breakup scene between me and Alex, because I Zasha was genuinely so sad that Shoshana and Ray were breaking up that I cried that day, like not on camera, but it was also sort of one of the first times I felt like Shoshana was having a truly tragic moment. And it was the first time that Alex and I had really gotten to like go toe-to-toe. And since then, we've gotten to work together quite a bit. And I adore him dearly as an actor and a human. But it was a day that I was so grateful for my job. And I had been up until that moment. But to be able to span a spectrum of playing something so ridiculous, like a scene on a couch with Hannah talking about my dead grandmother and like eating pudding in a like, what is that thing called?
Snuggie.
A snuggie.
I still have that snuggie.
It's a great snuggie. And then having a day like that where we filmed this very real, very honest, very upsetting breakup scene. It just made me, it made me feel truly grateful and excited to have that be my workplace and to be telling a story that was that brave and real, for lack of a better word.
You ready yet, Tamara Marsh?
I'm ready. I was thinking the whole time about my own.
Great.
But I was going to say that my favorite scene was working with you that first day with the pink jumpsuit and in our apartment. And I was like, oh my God, I'm obsessed with this person. She's so good. And you really, we were doing a lot more improv in the beginning in that first season.
We improved so much that day.
Oh my God.
I was so nervous.
I don't know if it was my very first day on Girls, but
I think it was, yeah.
Judd and you were just change the line every time. And I was like,
it was so fun.
I got to use every joke that I think is hilarious and just like make you guys hear it. It was great.
You were great. And you really did fall in love with us. You were like, she's really good. And I was like, yeah, because unlike us, she's a professional actor.
One of the most fun times I've ever had on set, aside from, we only were together 12 times as a foursome throughout the whole series, which was sad to me every day we weren't all together. But even though I know it wasn't realistic, etc. But one of the most fun times I had, aside from all those times, was shooting Marnie's music video for What I Am. Which was, it was one of the most creatively fulfilling and satisfying experiences I have ever had, because I got to get out of my system everything about other amateur music videos that's always bothered me, things I'm embarrassed about my own amateur music videos. There's a full-length cut of it somewhere, and it is excruciating. I've never watched all of it. It's too hard.
You, like, aggressively, like, smoke a
e-cig.
Hot
early e-cig. Like, yeah, early generation e-cig. That was like one of the most fun. And then, I mean, one of the most challenging was the return of Chris Abbott and navigating the very strange meta narrative that we were experiencing, which is that I, Allison, hadn't seen Chris since he left the show, and Marnie and Charlie also hadn't seen each other since they broke up. And so that was a very kind of confusing thing. But there we were in a rehearsal space at Silver Cup with you, and it was like, nothing had changed. And so that was hard, but it was really rewarding and very quickly was fun. And he has not become a raging drug addict with Humble Life tattooed on his stomach. Yeah.
Well, I'm very curious to hear what yours is. And it's hard. I mean, I just, every day that I showed up and were at work and got to watch these girls work, it's such a cliche, but it was just like, it was just always a joy to watch them go. Like, I always loved directing, like the most mundane moments between them. I really enjoyed when Jemima and Allison made out first season.
I loved that.
I loved that. But they were,
we
like,
were
both,
so giggly.
They were so giggly, and
we
I was like, are they gonna like go home and fuck? Like, they were really.
It's like, honestly, it's like my greatest regret in life is that I didn't aggressively pursue a relationship with Jemima.
It was so fun. I was like, is she gonna use tongue? Is she not?
I know, like, and I remember afterwards you were like, what kind of kisser do you think Allison's gonna be? And I was like, I don't know, grow up. And then afterwards you were like, she used a little bit of tongue. It was really nice. Like,
you guys got so mad at me because I'm an obsessive gum chewer and you hate mint as a taste. Yeah. Which is
I hate any freshener of any kind. I'd rather anything.
Jemima likes like a 3-day-old coffee breath.
Better than like the lie of the mint. Yeah.
Come on. You guys are definitely way more nervous than you were, than you were kissing any male co-star.
I was so excited.
It was great.
What do you want the legacy to be, or what do you think the show's legacy is going to be?
Well, it's interesting. I've been saying a lot, like, I hope that it helps people think about women as messy and complicated and containing multitudes, and that it's okay for women to be unsure and impolite. But, you know, one of the big goals when we started the show was also to really talk about female friendship in a really honest way, because so many films we see either depicted as this sort of like, you know, ride or die supportive perfection or catty infighting. And the truth about female friendship, I think we all know, is like it's a very deep love that lies somewhere between those things. And something that's so interesting is we've all become really close, but also like to write that stuff between Jessa and Hannah is interesting, because Jemima and I do have a 20-year
friendship that's had all of the complexities that two total lunatics being friends would encounter.
I think in terms of the legacy too, I'm encouraged to see that the aspirational as a mode in television is becoming less and less interesting to people, or even perhaps useful to people. It's nice to have escapism. It's nice to see a closet that you would dream of or something like that. But it's also really comforting and comfortable to see shreds of people who represent pieces of yourself, who mm-hmm. feel familiar. And I think it can be very isolating when there's such a massive amount of content in the world, if none of it felt like it applied to any part of your personality. Mm-hmm. But when you are working on a show like this, it's almost aggressively grounded and real, and tried to portray to the best of our ability what the actual existence of these four women would be. I think that is something that we continue to hear provides great comfort.
Yeah.
And I think it's important right now. And I think a lot of the shows that I love the most that are on the air now, that are coming out and have come out over the last couple of years, reflect that aesthetically and also thematically, which is a huge compliment. And, you know, I think a debt of gratitude is owed to Lena for some of those shows.
All right, so before we bounce this week, I want to play a little game. This is kind of a new segment. Maybe we'll do it more than once. I'm not sure, but we're going to do it this time. And this is a spinoff of something we've been texting back and forth to each other in a game that we've all kind of been playing in our heads.
We've all been playing it.
Since the election.
Let's not front.
Do you think XYZ voted for Trump? This is the game. This is the game I play when I'm on the subway, when I'm buying coffee at the bodega, when I'm watching TV. I don't know. So let me just set up the context real quick, and then I want you to explain a little bit more about why we're going to play this game this week.
Okay.
I bought the latest issue of Elle magazine because Zoe Kravitz was on the cover looking fine as all hell.
She looks really good.
She looks so good. Spitting image of her mother.
Lisa in the Bonet. Flesh.
The ghost resurrected, but Lisa's still alive, so I don't know how that works, but whatever.
Well,
there are
Lisa's
twins.
Still alive, but she's not working enough as far as I'm concerned, but whatever.
I know. Maybe she will be now. There was an interview, a four-way interview between Zoe Kravitz, Reese Witherspoon, Nicole Kidman, and Shailene Woodley, kind of, even though she didn't actually show up, but about their new show called Big Little Lies, which is airing on what network sometime later this year? Is it HBO? Okay.
Yeah. It's going to intersect with Girls at some point, I think.
It got me thinking, and I'll read part of the interview in a second, but it got me thinking about Reese Witherspoon and where she lies on this axis of politics
mm-hmm.
in the world.
Mm-hmm. But it's not just Reese Witherspoon, right?
It's not.
We just watched a Super Bowl whose entire framing was around this question of, do we want Team Trump, which would have been the New England Patriots, to win? Or do we want the nice American team, the Atlanta Falcons, to win?
Right.
First of
right.
all, nobody even knew Atlanta had a football team
That's
until
right.
like 2 weeks ago.
Also correct.
Rembert Brown was holding it down for the entire USA.
And Aaron Wack. Yeah.
I mean, and Aaron Wack, our friend Aaron Wack. I mean, it just clearly the need to propagate this narrative
right.
is going to keep showing up. We talked about how it's going to invade our award shows. I can't get a coffee without thinking about it. Like at my coffee shop, they keep track of the Trump people who come in and say weird things about Trump. They keep a little list
for
like guy in hat with glasses and beard,
right.
Trump voter. Like people are doing this already. It's kind of like reverse Gestapo.
I don't
know what the fallout is, but
we're all playing this game in our
heads.
We're
all playing this game.
And we should say this isn't about Reese in particular because the reason I had to text you is because I know we both share a deep burning love for Reese Witherspoon in different ways.
I love
okay.
that woman.
Legally Blonde is a movie that I can recite forward and backwards. I've seen Legally Blonde 2. If there's a third and a fourth one, I'll see those too. Like, I love those movies, okay? I want a chihuahua because she had a chihuahua in that movie.
You should never do that.
Okay, well, I'm going to get one.
Okay, so now we're just going to play the game. Let's just lay it out there. Contestant number one, Reese Witherspoon. Did she vote for Donald Trump?
Okay, let me present the evidence to the court. So in this interview, she says, so Reese Witherspoon is being asked about the show Big Little Lies, and the question is, the book takes place in Australia. Why is the series set in Monterey? She's a producer of the show. She stars in the show.
So Monterey, California is the setting. Okay.
Reese Witherspoon says, I'm just going to read this very quickly, this answer.
Monterey has both wealthy people and people who live hand-to-mouth. We purposely set in America because of the storytelling aspect, people living in different areas with a consciousness of urban versus rural, yet clearly living different lives. As an artist, I feel more strongly than ever that my job on Earth is to tell the stories of the invisibles and women who've been invisible in film for a very long time. No one's the good guy. No one's the bad guy. We all do deplorable things. So for me, here are the keywords. Invisible, rural, and deplorables.
Mm.
Like, I just feel like that is code to a very specific kind of reader who is reading that interview and wants to know, oh, she's on my side, or, oh, she's not on my side.
She's having it both ways.
She's really having it both ways. And she goes on to say different things, but I feel like there are a lot of key words in this article.
All right. Can we just talk before we get the drum roll rolling and I come down on whether or not she voted for Trump? We already know that Matthew McConaughey wants us to give the president a chance, which is, you know, a fair thing for one to ask in general.
Right.
Like, he is my president. This isn't about Donald Trump necessarily, but McConaughey's
Team T.
Reese Witherspoon's co-star on this show.
Yes.
Nicole Kidman.
Yes.
Academy Award nominee.
Yes.
Nicole Kidman.
And a citizen from Australia, but can vote. She's a citizen.
She can vote. Donald Trump supporter. We don't know that. What we know is that she said, get over it, basically.
Yeah.
This is an interesting position.
Now, when I first texted this to you, your response was, she's way too feral for that.
I don't think she voted for Donald Trump.
I want to agree with you. I'm still going to watch this show. I'm still going to watch this show. But I think she did.
Really?
I think she did. Honey, why would anyone use the word deplorables? We are deplorables, as in referencing when Hillary Rodham Clinton said basket of deplorables. She's reclaiming that word. That is a very specific word to use. It was a flashpoint during the election.
It's true.
To bring it up unprovoked in this new context, to me, feels like she's written it in lemon juice. She wants you to hold the article up to the light. She wants you to see it in brown. Invisible ink right there for you.
I don't think she did it. I think she might have been a little careless in her language. I do not think that Reese Witherspoon voted for Donald Trump. I also should say that my answer is kind of bound up in my love of Tracy Flick, the character Reese Witherspoon played in Election, which, depending on your political situation, could be read either way. She could have been Hillary Clinton.
She could have been Donald Trump. Yeah.
I mean, the milkshake throwing at Matthew Broderick at the end of that movie.
Classic. She's no Melania, that's for sure. That movie's insane. That movie's phenomenally good.
Oh,
if you haven't seen Election, you need to watch it.
Election's perfect. Yeah. Election's a perfect American movie.
So it's a draw. We're nowhere closer to an answer, but we're not done playing this game.
No, we'll be playing this for a long time, I suspect.
Longer than I want to, but, you know.
All right, that's our show.
That's our show. On that note.
Still processing. Product of the New York Times.
Pump it up, man. Pump it up. Still processing as a product.
I don't want the show to end. That's our show. It's a product of the New York Times and is produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, Henry Malofsky, Ricky Nowetzki, and Max Linsky for Pineapple Street Media.
And a special thank you for editorial oversight from Samantha Hennig and Lisa Tobin.
Our music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly.
You can find all of our past episodes, cool links, and various things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. That's all, folks.
Talk to you guys
later. And also, this episode goes out to Red and Yellow, the yet-to-be-born new babies in Beyoncé's stomach. Love you guys already. Three hearts. She has three hearts.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.